This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Jake Tapper has had some challenging encounters with members of the Trump administration who he's interviewed on CNN, people who have stated falsehoods or evaded his questions. After Trump advisor Stephen Miller evaded Tapper's questions, Tapper terminated the interview, saying that Miller was wasting his audience's time. Tapper insists on facts and answers to his questions. He's CNN's chief Washington correspondent and anchor of The Lead every weekday afternoon and State of the Union every Sunday. In a few minutes, we'll talk about anchoring his shows in the Trump era, but first we're going to talk about his new debut novel, The Hellfire Club. It's set in Washington, D.C. in 1954, during the McCarthy communist witch hunt era. The main character is a history professor who becomes a congressman. Several key people from the period are depicted in the novel, including Senator Joe McCarthy, Roy Cohn, President Eisenhower, and John and Robert Kennedy. Jake Tapper, welcome back to Fresh Air. My first question is, what's wrong with you? You're writing a novel when you host a show 6 days a week. You have to prepare for presidential debates, town hall forums. You have a wife and two children. You do cartoons at the end of your Sunday show. How did you manage to write a novel, and why would you want to take that on? I mean, wouldn't you rather take a nap or something?
So I will grant your larger point that something is seriously wrong with me. I agree with that. I have just stumbled upon all these rich moments in history that I didn't think I would be able to write about well in a nonfiction way, but thought it would be fun to try to do it in a fictional way. All these interesting things from the 18th century and from the early 1950s and just Washington lore. And, you know, I think after living in Washington, D.C. for a generation, more than a generation, there were just a few things, impressions I have of this town that I thought would be fun to capture in a work of fiction. And in terms of how I did it, it was just a lot of, first of all, just focusing on the outline was a big part of it, because then I had a blueprint and it was much easier to write. And then second of all, I carried around a laptop with me, and I just subscribed to the, if you have 15 minutes here or an hour there or time on a plane or time on a train, grab it, and the time adds up.
So why is it set in 1954?
It's such an incredible time in history, and we don't really pay a lot of attention to it in a pop culture way. Understandably, I guess, because it's sandwiched between World War II and the 60s, which were, you know, arguably bigger and more important decades. But it's such a great decade because on its surface, there is this serenity and it seems benign. It's the Eisenhower years. Everything's going great. But right underneath the surface, it's awful. There's McCarthyism. There's the Red Scare. There's the atomic race. Civil rights are basically non-existent. In the section of 1954 that I write about, early 1954, the Supreme Court decision Brown versus the Board of Education is about to come down, and everyone's bracing for it. 1954, McCarthy enters the year at the height of his power. And then there's also just these random weird events that take place. Puerto Rican terrorists burst into the Capitol and shoot it up and shoot five congressmen. There's the comic book hearings, which are this bizarre moment where the U.S. Senate blames comic books for juvenile delinquency. So it was just such a rich era. I thought it would be fun to try to capture the swamp and some other things about Washington and talk about 2018 in some ways, but doing so from the lens of 1954.
You wrote this novel over the course of at least 4 years. So you started during the Obama administration, then continued working on it during the Trump administration. Did that change the focus, the emphasis of the novel at all?
It did a bit. And also, it did not because of me, but just because of events. So let me explain. There's a lot in this book about the Washington, D.C. swamp. And there's a lot in this book about Joe McCarthy and what he was doing to the Republic in early 1954 and in the previous years, which was smearing and lying and behaving indecently, ruining people. And the Republican Party and the Democratic Party and the media, to an extent as well, just letting him do it because they were afraid that if they said anything, they would be attacked too. So obviously that's very resonant to what's going on today with President Trump. They say history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And there's a lot of rhyming when you read about McCarthy when you think about President Trump. Obviously, President Trump is not searching for communists. It's different, and they're different people. But the dilemmas were the same.
Let's talk about your work as a journalist now. And I want to start with a clip from one of your greatest hits, so to speak. And this is your interview with President Trump's senior advisor for policy, Stephen Miller. This is from January 8th of 2018. And you're talking to him about Michael Wolff's then newly published book, Fire and Fury, which is a behind-the-scenes look of the early days of the Trump White House. So here is an excerpt of that interview. In fact, this is the final part of that interview.
I want to ask you, because you obviously are very offended by the notion that this book, Fire and Fury, paints a picture of President Trump is not mentally up to the job. On Saturday, President Trump put out a series of tweets trying to defend himself on this issue of fitness. And he said, quote, "Actually, throughout my life, my two greatest assets have been mental stability and being, like, really smart. Crooked Hillary Clinton also played these cards very hard and, as everyone knows, went down in flames. I went from very successful businessman to top TV star to President of the United States on my first try. I think that would qualify as not smart, but genius, and a very stable genius at that." Do you think tweets like that help or hurt the cause that the president is stable and up for the job?
Not only do I think they help it, but I think in the toxic environment that you've created here in CNN and cable news, which is a real crisis of legitimacy for your network, and we saw it, of course, with the extremely fake news you reported about the Don Jr. and WikiLeaks story. There was a huge embarrassment for your network.
Stephen.
Just like the huge embarrassment you had when you got the Comey testimony wrong.
Stephen, I'm trying to get to the issue of the president's fitness, which a lot of people are questioning.
And I'm getting to the issue of your fitness. But the president's tweets absolutely reaffirmed the plain spoken truth. A self-made billionaire revolutionized reality TV and tapped into something magical that's happening in the hearts of this country. The people that you
don't... The president has approval rating in the 30s. I don't know what magical you're talking about.
The people that you don't connect with and understand, the people whose manufacturing jobs have left, who've been besieged by high-crime communities, and who've been affected by a policy of uncontrolled immigration, those voices, those experiences, don't get covered on this network. That's why, to prove the point, I was booked to talk about the very issues I'm just describing, and you're not even asking about them because they're not interesting facts to you.
That's not true. I have plenty of questions on immigration. You've attempted to filibuster by talking about your flights with the president.
I
want to ask you a question because
don't be condescending. Jake.
Stephen.
Jake,
The
reason why I want to talk about the president's experiences, what I've seen with him traveling to meet dozens of foreign leaders, with his incredible work.
Okay, you're not answering the questions.
No,
I understand.
You have 24 hours a day of anti-Trump material. You're not going to give 3 minutes for the American people the real experience of Donald Trump.
There's one viewer that you care about right now, and you're being obsequious.
You're being a factotum in order to please him.
Okay.
No.
And I think I've wasted enough of my viewers' time.
You know
Thank
who
you,
I care
Stephen.
About?
As Republicans,
hey,
lawmakers
Jake,
call for Attorney General
about?
Jeff Sessions to resign, in a major reversal, Democrats are now coming to his defense. What changed? We'll ask the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee next.
Wow. So that was Jake Tapper with Stephen Miller.
I haven't listened to that since it happened.
Oh, what did you think listening back to it?
He's even worse than I remember.
I remember seeing that as it happened on a Sunday morning. And I thought, oh, whoa, have you ever done that before, ended an interview by saying the guest was wasting your audience's time?
No, but, I mean, I'd never had an interview like that before. I mean, it's just appalling behavior. I read a tweet to him and asked him if he thought that that helped or hurt the president's cause. It's a pretty, I mean, it's the president's tweet, the president's statement. It's not that difficult a question, and it's pretty obvious that I was going to ask about it. It was the very stable genius tweet, which remains fairly notorious or famous, depending on your point of view, to this day. And to like go through a litany of attacks on my network, on me personally, saying that I don't care about manufacturing jobs, that I don't care about real people. It's just a lie, and it's just a I should have cut him off earlier.
It seems to me what he's doing there is a strategy, you know, a deflection strategy. Instead of answering the question, he's criticizing you, he's criticizing CNN, he's criticizing fake news, and he's not answering the question at all. Do you think of that as a strategy of just like deflecting, trying to make you and your network seem like you're the problem?
Right. Obviously, yes. I mean, 100%. But then also just the notion that a toxic environment has been created by CNN is, it's just not true. I mean, this is what they want to do, is they want people like me to then get into the gutter and talk about who's guilty or who's not guilty. But I'll just say this. It's very clear that there are basic standards of truth and decency that have nothing to do with partisan politics, that this president and his minions regularly violate and regularly abuse and cross, whether the president is deriding a former aide, making light of his struggles with drug and alcohol dependency, or mimicking a reporter who has a disability, or claiming that Ted Cruz's dad has some connection to the Kennedy assassination, and on and on. It's just very clear that regardless of your position on trade or immigration or terrorism or taxes, positions that I do not make a judgment about one way or the other, there's a whole policy level of the Trump administration that we just try to discuss and debate in the way that we would discuss and debate any policy. But then there's these lines that are crossed.
Mm-hmm. As an interviewer, I'm interested in how you handle this. When the guest won't let you speak, because I think another tactic that Stephen Miller was using in that interview is to not stop talking, to not allow you to get in a question, to not allow you to insist in an audible way, because he's talking over you, to insist that he answer the question that you asked, as opposed to just hurling insults at you and your network and the media. So what goes through your mind when that's happening, about how soon to jump in, how much to try to talk over him?
Well, first of all, what was going through my mind is I have known Stephen Miller for years.
Oh, you have?
Yeah. He was a press secretary on Capitol Hill. And until that morning, I had a fine relationship with him. I mean, I have his number. I have his email. I had even defended him a few times on Twitter and places like that when there were things that I thought had gone too far, like calling him a Nazi. I think it's a bit too far, considering that he's Jewish. So I was surprised, because Trump's going to leave someday. Maybe it will be a full two terms, maybe it won't. But I'm going to be here, and Stephen Miller's going to be here. So I'm always surprised when people, on a professional level, throw away a relationship. But then beyond that, it was just an eruption of indecency that I just wasn't expecting.
Now, I've read that Stephen Miller refused to leave the set after the interview and had to be escorted out by security. What did happen?
He kept talking during the commercial break.
Talking to you?
Yes.
Trying to make what point?
Just the same attacks on me and CNN. And I mean, just basically what you heard on camera, he was saying off camera. And eventually, you know, we were ticking down. And I said, okay, you have to go. And he wouldn't go. And it got heated. And before we came back from commercial break, he had to be escorted out. And then he went on Fox and denied it the next day, which is also odd because, you know, one thing that we have in abundance at a TV studio is cameras filming things. So it was odd to hear him deny that. But these people lie about everything, so why wouldn't he lie about that?
Did you release the tape of him being escorted out?
No, because I don't want to be the story. I don't like being the story. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, he knows the truth. He knows that a guard escorted him out of the studio, down the elevator, through the lobby, out the door. I mean, he knows that happened. He didn't pose a threat to me, but he was not leaving the studio, and we were coming back from commercial break on a live TV show.
Did the Trump administration stop sending him out after that?
I haven't seen him very much on TV since then. I think he went on a couple more times. I think it's one of the reasons that you don't see him on very often is likely because that's how he comes across on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Probably after this interview airs, they'll put him out three times just to prove me wrong, because that's how the Trump administration rolls. I mean, we know this from reporting that Maggie Haberman from the New York Times will report something, or CNN will report something, and then President Trump will not carry out what he was about to do just to spite us. So he'll wait three extra months to fire Rex Tillerson just because we had said he was talking about firing Rex Tillerson.
Really? You think that's a strategy?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we know it's a strategy. He doesn't want to prove us right. He'll tell people he's about to fire Rex Tillerson. We report it. And then just to mess with us and to prove us wrong, he waits a few months. Hmm. I'm sure you've figured this out, Terry. I listened to your coverage. He's an unusual man driven by a very strong sense of grievance.
So, Jake, one of the things you've done is anchor presidential primary debates, presidential debates. What's your favorite type of format for those kinds of debates? And if you could change, like, what would your ideal format be?
Well, first of all, let me say that they're so much fun. I mean, I remember
watching.
Oh, God,
are they really?
Well, in a way,
the pressure must be so extraordinary.
The pressure is very intense, and it's very high stakes and all that. But as a political junkie, as somebody who remembers watching presidential debates in the 1980s when I was a kid, it's cool sitting in the best seat in the House and asking questions. That's just fun. And yeah, I mean, it comes with a whole, it's not all fun, but that side of it is just an amazing experience and humbling and challenging and everything like that. I will say, so we did the Republican, I moderated the Republican presidential debates in September 2015. First, we did an undercard debate with the four people who didn't make the main stage. And then I did the main debate, which had 11 people because it was supposed to be the top 10. But then Carly Fiorina kind of like muscled her way on stage. So it was 11. And I will say that's too many people. You know, when you have 11 people and I think it was a 3-hour debate. God, was it? Oh, my God, I think it was. Then it's just a crush for time. People are just so desperate to get to say something. I'm still echoing in my head is Jake, 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 senators and governors, Jake, Jake. Oh, my God. So I think that's too many people. But that said, it's fun.
I've often wondered if networks should have like a crawl at the bottom of the screen fact-checking so that the debate moderator wouldn't have to worry about that. You could just focus on the next question, but viewers would have this constant stream of corrections.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a perfect world, it's like pop-up video on VH1 back 10 or 15 years ago where, you know, President Trump or Ted Cruz or Hillary Clinton says something and it's just like, whoop, you know, actually the trade deficit was, you know. But the truth is that having done fact-checking now, starting at the ABC News fact-check desk in 2004 and continuing throughout my career today, we do a weekly fact-check for State of the Union at CNN.com and factcheck.org. In partnership with them. I mean, we take it very seriously. The truth of the matter is that instantaneous fact-checking is tough, that it usually takes a little while to make it happen. The problem is it becomes easier if people repeat lies, and then you can do more instantaneous ones. Thankfully or not for this president and the fact-checking folks, he tends to repeat lies all the time, so they're able to recycle a lot of them, and maybe more instantaneous ones would be possible for future debates, if there are future debates.
So one more thing. You wanted to be a cartoonist when you were young, an editorial cartoonist. And I feel like you're drawing on that in your tweets, because your tweets are usually really funny. And so do you feel that way, that you're drawing on some of the things that you wanted to do as a cartoonist when you tweet now?
Maybe. I mean, it's the same kind of writing in short form to make a point. There's a beauty in it.
With humor.
With humor. I think the people who do it the best are people like Albert Brooks and Steve Martin. And, you know, there are a bunch of people I wish were on Twitter that aren't, like Martin Short. You know, Jimmy Kimmel, Seth Meyers, Conan is hilarious on Twitter. I compare myself to them and I'm nothing. But I do try to use, I mean, Twitter is it's evil. We're all going to die because of Twitter. But by the same token, it is a rare thing unto itself. I preferred it, I have to say, when it was 140 characters. I thought that there was more of a challenge. It was like a haiku. There were limits, and now it's just rambling. I mean, I thought, and just as an artistic matter, I thought President Trump's tweets were better under the 180 character or 140 character instead of 280. They were, there was a, you know, it was declarative statement, adjective. And
exclamation point.
With an exclamation point, sometimes all caps. And there was a beauty's the wrong word, but there was an art to them. There was something too. There was a skill. And now they're just kind of like rambling messes. If he had just stayed within the lines, maybe those tweets would be as beautiful as they once were. And when I say beautiful, I mean horrific.
Jake Tapper, it has been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much, and good luck with your novel.
Thank you so much.
Jake Tapper has a new novel called The Hellfire Club. You can see his CNN show, The Lead, every weekday. His show, State of the Union, is on Sundays. In the late 1950s, trumpeter and singer Louis Armstrong was usually on the road with his Dixielandish small band, the All-Stars. He recorded with that band a lot, but was occasionally coaxed into the studio to play music in a different vein. A new reissue presents recordings Armstrong made for the Verve label in 1957. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
When you were alone, who cares for starlit skies? When you were alone, the magic moonlight dies.
Louis Armstrong, Out of His Usual Context, August 1957. It's a little shocking, the contrast between his sandpaper voice and Russ Garcia's silky orchestra. This sort of lush treatment is usually reserved for more genteel singers. Still, Armstrong was the most influential vocalist of the 20th century. The way his phrasing inspired Bing Crosby and Billie Holiday alone ensure that. Armstrong's rough voice never tripped up his timing. Often it accented the wit behind his reading of a lyric, even when he sang a song straight, like this Ellington gem.
Someone told someone, and someone told you, but they wouldn't hurt you, not much. Since everyone spread the story, with his own little personal touch, do nothing till you hear from me. Pay no attention to what's said. Why people tear the seams of anyone's dream is over my head.
Louis Armstrong was one of those proverbial hardest working men in show business. He cut these orchestra sides during four consecutive days at a Los Angeles studio while performing at night in Las Vegas with his All-Stars. He mostly sings here, owing to painful lip trouble. But Armstrong the trumpeter still knocked out a few heroic melody statements. This is Stormy Weather. Orchestra sessions comprise half of Pops is Tops, a four-CD compilation of Louis Armstrong's 1957 studio recordings for Verve. Hearing him sidestep and confront technical limitations and fatigue reminds me of late 50s records by his great admirer, Billie Holiday. The resemblance between them was never plainer. Here's Billie in 1958 on For Heaven's Sake.
Don't say a word, my darling, Don't break a spell like this. Just hold me tight. We're alone in the night, and heaven is here in a kiss. This pair of eyes.
Now Armstrong, 6 months earlier, on a different song, with that same conversational world weariness and heavy vibrato and those strangulated high notes. But he's more playful. Listen to those drawn-out S's.
Sit there and count your fingers. What can you do? Old girl, you're through. Sit there and count your little fingers. Unlucky little girl blue.
The second half of the anthology, Pops Is Tops, pairs Louis Armstrong with the Verve label's star pianist, Oscar Peterson. Like the trumpeter, a virtuoso who knew not to flaunt it all the time. On an October session, Lewis's lip sounds more confident, and the quartet's terrific beat inspires him. His Tops includes a wealth of alternate and incomplete takes, warm-ups and rehearsal sequences that help lay bare the studio process and contain a few endearing moments. It's clear Armstrong isn't so familiar with some tunes put in front of him, but he was always a quick study. If he hadn't been, records like these wouldn't even exist.
So goodbye, dear. Amen. Yes, oh. We meet now and then. It was great fun. It was just one of those things.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. Coming up, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gregory Pardlow about his new book, Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. 13,000 people were fired by President Reagan when he broke up the Air Traffic Controllers Union after they went out on strike in 1981. One of the people who lost his job was the father of my guest, Gregory Pardlow. How that changed Pardlow's life and his father's is just part of what Pardlow writes about in his new book, Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. Pardlow won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. Getting there wasn't easy. There were periods when his family struggled financially. He joined the Marine Reserves, hoping it would help him with college tuition. But as soon as he got to boot camp, he tried to get out. He used to drink too much. His family was on the A&E reality show Intervention, which brings family members together to organize an intervention for their family member who is addicted. The intervention wasn't for Pardlo, it was for his brother. Pardlo now lives in Brooklyn with his wife and two children. He teaches at Rutgers University, Camden. Gregory Pardlo, welcome to Fresh Air. I really love your new memoir, and I'm going to ask you to read the first paragraph from it.
My pleasure. The title is Route 66. By some concoction of sugar, nicotine, prescription painkillers, rancor, and cocaine, my father, Gregory Pardlo Sr., began killing himself after my parents separated in 2007. He measured his health and lifestyle against his will to live and determined he had 10 years left in the tank. Though he did screw up and live past 65, as he was afraid he might, he was only a year over budget. He lived his last years like a child with a handful of tokens at an arcade near closing time. Those tokens included access to credit, the patience and generosity of his family and friends, and any saleable assets, including, possibly, the titanium urn that contained his mother's ashes, mysteriously missing from the one-bedroom Las Vegas apartment where he chose to fizzle out. These resources had to be exhausted. He didn't want to endure penury, but neither would he ever leave money on the table, as he often put it. He died without leaving a will or naming beneficiaries.
So your father died in 2016 while you were finishing your book, but the book begins with your father's death. So that's obviously a change you made to your book after he died. And really you're starting your book by pointing your finger at your father and saying, this is how he died, kind of a screw up, getting in debt, taking advantage of things, you know, as it, taking advantage of his credit, of your family.
So yeah, the goodwill.
Your family's goodwill. So it's a kind of angry way to start a book that your father figures prominently in. And I'm curious. So many books start with like, my mother died and I was so sad, I'll never recover. And like, this is a different start.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that there's some anger in. Well, there was considerable anger, to be honest. After he passed, I found myself feeling a lot of the feelings that I wouldn't allow myself to experience before while he was alive. And a lot of that was just the freedom, the permission to be angry and resentful. And I know it's a kind of petulant way to begin the book, but I also knew when I went back to revise or rearrange the book, my love for him and admiration for him was woven into the narratives of the book.
Like a lot of children, you were the result of an unplanned pregnancy. Your mother was 21, your father 19. They married after she got pregnant. And you think your father didn't want to have a child, at least not at that point in his life, and that he felt like your birth prevented him from doing some things he wanted to do. Did he ever say that up front, or what led you to feel that way?
No, he never said that, but I was aware of his history before my mother was pregnant, and that was he had had a full scholarship to Cheney State University, and he was a civil rights activist. He considered himself a civil rights activist. And so I know with his ambition, considering his ambitions and the momentum of his life, he had higher aspirations. And I think in following how he adapted those ambitions to air traffic control, my sense was that he was making up for the detour of having to become a family man.
So your family story intersects with a very important chapter of labor history. Your father was an air traffic controller. He was a member of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, known as PATCO. And in 1981, PATCO went on strike. What were they asking for?
Well, they were asking for reduced working hours. They were asking for a regularized schedule. They wanted updated equipment. They were still using, at that time in 1981, they were still using equipment from the Second World War. And not insignificantly, they were asking for a considerable raise. There were some other smaller perks involved in the package, but they were all negotiable.
In a very controversial move, President Reagan broke the union. His attorney general said, show up to work within the next 48 hours or be terminated. The Reagan administration fired 13,000 people who were air traffic controllers, including your father, and the union was broken. You write that key figures in the strike were threatened with arrest. Did that include your father?
Absolutely. Technically, it included everyone, all of the controllers. But because my father, at that point, he was very much on television and in the media quite a bit, which made him a very visible target. And so he actually went on the lam for several weeks, right after the strike, as well as, you know, long after. And we, my mother and I and my baby brother, didn't see him for a while. But we did see the federal marshals parked outside of our house. My mother did see the federal marshals in the parking lot outside of her job. At one point, my mother says, I don't remember this one, but my mother says the federal marshals even followed me as a kid when I went to play at friends' houses. I remember another incident where the marshals actually came up to the house and they asked for my father. I answered the door. And I was really struck by how the one marshal opened his jacket, ostensibly to show me his badge, but what he also showed me was the gun holstered under his arm. And I had two reactions to that. One was, this is serious. You know, we're not play acting at this anymore. And the other was, this is serious. This is my moment to protect the home. I have to step into a considerable amount of responsibility. And by gummit, I'm going to do it.
Which meant doing what or not doing what?
Which meant, I mean, if only in my head, right? I don't know. The marshals probably didn't register any transformation in the little boy standing in front of them. But in my mind, the deference with which I wouldn't ordinarily have treated these men went out the window. And I claimed, you know, my back straightened up a bit, and I claimed for myself the right to speak to them, not as respected adults as I had been raised to do.
Was it upsetting to you when you were 12 to see your father, who had helped maintain air safety? He would tell you what it was like to have to balance having all these like planes heading in different directions and making sure they didn't crash into each other. And like, yeah, that's a pretty thrilling thing, I think, for a boy to think of his father doing. But then you were watching your father at loose ends, not knowing where he was going to go next, not having to shape a new identity for himself, not mm-hmm. making money for a while, smoking a lot of weed. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like more so than, you know,
More so than he had, yeah.
So what impact did it have on you to see your father have to figure out again, who am I? What am I doing?
Well, that's something I'm still hashing out with my therapist, you know, how, what that meant for me. And I think for any kid, you know, looking up to any boy, certainly looking up to his father, and you know, and I'm granting that there are some aspects of masculinity that I'm not entirely down with anymore, you know, as an adult. But as a kid, I bought into the narratives of masculinity very much, and I guess I was really rooting for my father. You know, get up, Dad, get up, get back in the ring. You know, he and I loved Rocky, and we loved a lot of movies and watched a lot of movies together. But seeing him struggle with having to create a new narrative for himself, in some sense, the way I responded to that was by placing myself in similar situations. And this is unconsciously, right? And this, I'm only aware of this looking back over the arc of my life thus far. But I can see how I, as I say, unconsciously stepped into or created moments of crisis in my life so that I could replay my father's critical moment.
But replay it, but have a good ending?
Right. I wanted to transcend the moment in honor of my father. But of course, what I was also doing was just creating unnecessary problems in my life. And so the challenge that I work with, that I'm working with my therapist, is separating myself and my identity still from my dad's. He was very much the kind of guy, and I think this is common among many American men, who viewed his family as merely extensions of himself. And the family as an institution was, you know, he was at the head of that, and I had wholeheartedly, patriotically, you know, in the very dictionary sense of the word, bought into the structure of the family with him at the helm.
There's a paragraph I want you to read from your memoir that's about identity. It's on page 148. Would you read it for us?
Sure. I don't care to be considered American to the exclusion of my African-Americanness. I don't want to be considered post-black or ex-colored. If I was raised black, for the most part, it was for economic reasons and apathy. Growing up, my family was not observant, preferring instead to derive our esprit de corps from the community of consumers we'd gather in fellowship with in the Tabernacle of Macy's, the Mead Hall of IKEA. I am not a practicing black.
What do you mean by a practicing black?
Oh, boy. So I can hear the groans of many African Americans right now. So there's this orthodoxy around race, and you know, and I think there's we very hypocritically say on one hand that there's nothing essential about race, that you know, you're not born a race, but on the other hand, there is something unchangeable, eternal about one's racial condition. And I approach it from the perspective of writing. I understand absolutely the social and political ramifications of race, right? If I go out into the world and not acknowledge the fact that I am black, I could walk into great danger. However, in my head and on the page as I'm writing, I think there's a way of thinking about race that I grew up with that allows me to deploy race strategically, both in my defense or as a means of protection, as a means of identification, as a means of bonding. And that expression is, for me, cultural, primarily cultural. The danger in saying this is that the ways we talk about race, if you say that race is, in my mind, as I conceive of it, merely cultural, what people tend to hear and actually want to hear is that I'm rejecting my blackness, I'm rejecting my family and community and ancestors, and that is absolutely not the case. What I wanted to do in this book, and I hope I approach in some way, is to destabilize, to undermine the sense of race as orthodoxy that doesn't get challenged or thought about in transgressive ways, frankly.
So you won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry, but your first book of poetry, when that was published, and what year are we talking?
2007.
So that year, when you had your book party, your family was at the book party, mm-hmm. but that was the night that your father officially left your mother. It kind of fits into my theory, which I've expressed before on our show, that often when something really wonderful happens in your professional life, something really awful is happening in your personal mm-hmm. life to counterbalance the good news. So did you feel that way? Like
Well, Fortunately for me, I wasn't aware of what had happened. My mother told me the story much later. I was aware of the difficulties my parents were having, but it was, and I was certainly aware of my father's behavior at the party. He wasn't acting out, but he wasn't the enthusiastic kind of, you know, gregarious guy that he would normally have been in a gathering like that.
So one more thing. When you were young and you misbehaved, your father would punish you by making you read a word in a dictionary, find like the etymology of the word, put it down in writing, and like you are a word guy. So in some ways, it was probably teaching you to hate the dictionary, but in other ways, to really appreciate the history of individual words and the subtlety of their meaning. So looking back at that punishment in retrospect, what do you think of it?
Oh, it was fantastic. Well, again, consistent with my father, I think in some way he was showing off. He was demonstrating, he was performing for me his vocabulary and his prowess with language. And so there was a kind of intended intimidation involved in that. And that's just pointing out the negative aspects of it. There was certainly the positive aspects in which he wanted me to expand my vocabulary. He was very much invested in that. But my response to it was to identify with his verbal dexterity and to enjoy and to view that punishment as a way of getting closer to my dad. And so that's the takeaway that I grew up with.
Well, Gregory Parlow, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Gregory Parlow's new book is called Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America.